Hi and welcome to Humans, Talks with Future Makers. Well, our today's guest is a writer, thinker, journalist, author from Turkey, Ece Temelkuran. And a quick note before we start, we have recorded this interview some weeks before the disastrous earthquakes in Syria and Turkey. Therefore, the topic is not included in our discussion, in case you wonder why we did not talk about that. Let's go. All right, I will be completely transparent here. I'm a big fan of our guest today, so I'm probably a tiny bit biased. Also, I'm a bit nervous because after having made over 100 episodes of this podcast, this is the very first one I'm doing in English, so excuse my mistakes in advance. That up front, our guest is an author and a thinker, of course, from Turkey. However, she doesn't live in Turkey anymore. She has been living mostly in Croatia ever since Turkey has become unlivable in for her. She went to Zagreb with, what I heard, two pairs of pants and a shirt in 2016 and stayed. For the moment, she's living in Hamburg working for the new institute. Some people would say she lives in exile, but she doesn't like that term at all. Maybe she will explain why she doesn't like that term. Back in the time, she studied law, started working as a journalist at the age of 19, and was soon writing political columns for major Turkish newspapers. However, when she criticized the leading government in her articles, she lost her job in 2011. But, of course, she kept on writing. Her reporting on the 2013 protests in Turkey have been translated into many languages. She has written for The Guardian, Le Monde Diplomatique, and she has written 12 books, novels, and nonfiction, the latest being called Together, 10 Choices for a Better Now, which I would call something like a poetic non-fiction book. But anyway, we will talk about that book as well. Bienvenue and welcome, Ece Temelkuran.
Hi, Bianca. And upfront, thank you so much for calling it poetic non-fiction. I'm struggling with the genre thing pretty much since the last years, because this is a long story, but very briefly, Anglo-Saxon publishing is very much obsessed with, you know, where in the bookshelves are we going to put this book? So poetic nonfiction, yes, this is what I'm trying to do. Thank you for calling that. It's such a pleasure being with you, although a little bit embarrassing after hearing the fan part. All right. Let's start with the exile thing. I have a long list, actually, why I don't want to be called an exile. First, I think it's a, you know, title of privilege, like an aristocratic title. And as any aristocracy, exiledom, exileness, whatever, is pretty boring, you know. I kind of reject that distinguished position because there are so many refugees in the world now, millions and millions of them. And believe me, their stories are more interesting than mine. And, you know, the second thing is, once you're in exile, you're always in exile. It takes away your return ticket, so to speak. Another thing is, we're all losing home in one way or another. Like, you don't even have to be a refugee to have lost your home. Even people living, like, you know, the most secure humans on the planet, like upper middle class Europeans, let's say, they're kind of losing their homes because they every day feel like this is not their country anymore. Morally and politically, the insanity makes them feel homeless, etc. So when there are so many homelesses in the world, it is such a bore to point out, to emphasize my situation. And also, once you're in exile, especially when if you're a woman, my God, I mean, like, in the Western world, you are thrown into this pit that you cannot climb out of, and it's the pit of victimhood. And I don't like that. It is kind of damaging my pride and dignity, I think. And you are also obliged to tell one story and only one story, and that's your own story, which is something that I really truly find a little bit boring. Yeah, and this list goes on, of course, but these are the most important, you know, items on that list of my rejection of being an exile. Also, there's the fact that once you're in exile, I'm like, in any interview they have with you, you have this big photo of Recep Tayyip Erdogan and smaller photo of you. And it really annoys me. I want to have the bigger space on the page.
I see. You just mentioned that so many people, and not only refugees, are losing their homes, their sense of belonging. This is how I also translate what you just said. And I guess, and this is my theory, this is what your book is about, you know, together. You also said at the beginning that you're having this problem being put into some kind of genre. So I would like to be a bit blunt and start with a pop cultural reference that has been stuck in my head ever since I started reading your book and also in preparation for this talk. And I would like to read you some little part of that song that is stuck in my head. And I'm very curious what you think about that. So, we are the children, the last generation. We are the ones they left behind. And I wonder when we are ever gonna change, living under the fear till nothing else remains. We don't need another hero.
Shall I sing you a song?
Yes, please, because I was thinking about playing it, but I'm probably not allowed to because of distribution rights. So if you can sing it, that would be lovely.
Oh, okay, I won't. But yeah, we don't need another hero. I think this is one of the most important aspects of our era. We don't need another hero, and we do not like heroes anymore. I was thinking about this subject lately. I was thinking about what is new politics, what is new way of doing politics, and I was thinking about Greta Thunberg, and she is a leader, a natural leader, so to speak. And what she does is interesting, and this could be a very important lesson for the 21st century political leaders. She rejects to be a leader. She rejects power. Her relation to power is quite interesting, and one can talk for hours about that. So especially the new generation has this interesting relation with power. Normally, when we want to change the world, we aim at power. We want to take over the power. But this generation, as they reject many other things, they reject the power itself. So they are going for strength. And that's one of the chapters in Together anyway. That's what Together is about, partly, I think. It's about how we all feel homeless and how actually we are becoming each other's home. And that is the only way to survive in 21st century. Well, I'm right now working on another book. It's still not clear if I'm going to write it or not, but I'm thinking about the concept of home, and it's not only refugees, everybody's feeling like they're homeless, but also there is the fact that we are losing the ultimate home, the planet, even though this is not most of the time part of our daily conversations, enough of us at least. We somehow, somewhere deep inside, feel the loss already. We are already mourning for future, and we already feel the melancholy when we look at the sea, when we look at the mountains, when we look at the green, and we already think about the times we are not going to have them. So the homelessness, the sense of homelessness, is very present in 21st century. And one of the challenges of the century will be to learn how to live with this feeling and how to manage this feeling, both politically and morally. Because when you look at the world, and this is one of the reasons I wrote Together, by the way, you see that globally, the politics has been shaped by the loss of home. You know, think about Brexit, think about Trump, Putin, or any right-wing populist leader, any leader with fascist inclinations. They always played on the fear of losing home, or they promised the masses to build that, you know, great home, the old great home. So once you realize that the world politics and our social lives in general for the last decade has been, you know, shaped by this loss, one understands that you have to come up with a good argument that would, you know, refute their way of doing politics, their way of exploiting the fears of the people. So that's why I wrote Together, actually, to come up with a different kind of understanding of belonging, understanding of politics, understanding of connecting to how we connect to each other and so on.
I had several thoughts. First of all, because you were talking about, you know, neo-fascist or right-wing populist politics playing that fears and playing, you know, the politics of emotions, as you called it. First of all, how can we be immune for that? You know, because as you said, we many, many people feel this loss of home and this loss of belonging and loss of being together. How can we be immune against that play?
Well, you know, although Together looks like a, you know, pop philosophy book, it is an actual political thought book. I mean, it's a political thinking. So this is why I talked about fears, because fears are the main, let's say, political material that we will have to deal with. And if you don't want to be exploited, and like if you don't want masses to be directed by their fears and by those who exploit those fears, you have to come up with an answer. You cannot say don't be afraid. That's the worst thing that you can say to a person who is in fear. You cannot say that those fears are groundless. No, there are fears, and these fears have become so prominent, so dominant, that now they're shaping the world politics. So you have to have another understanding of fear. You have to come up with another remedy. My remedy is to say that, yes, we are afraid, and we have to learn to befriend these fears. Otherwise, we are going to be enslaved by them. So actually, we have to exercise, we have to practice to befriend the fear. We've seen this during the pandemic. There was massive fear all around the world. What did we do? I mean, like, I'm not kind of inventing these remedies, so to speak, on my own. I'm looking at the humans, how they react to things and so on. And what we did as humankind during the pandemic was not complete isolation, was not like, you know, we didn't run away from streets to our houses, and we didn't really completely isolate ourselves. Actually, we were in solidarity. So we saw that solidarity is inherent in humans. That was a very important merit that we saw happening in real time during pandemic. Yes, of course, there were people who were trying to make money out of these fears. There were people who were cheating other people by selling, I don't know, fake vaccines or whatever. Of course, there was evil there. There was, you know, the inherent evil in human being. But the other part, the solidarity part, was there as well. And more importantly, maybe, we were after our dignity. During the pandemic, several things happened. Black Lives Matter happened. There were many other protests. So people were on streets hugging each other, like, you know, or shoulder to shoulder, and they were asking for their dignity. So even when there was fear of, there was this fatal fear, and it was an invisible thing, it was really like a dystopian movie suddenly. But even then, we weren't really enslaved. Not many of us were enslaved by their fears. They were on streets either, you know, to show solidarity to the others, to the weaker ones, or they were asking for their dignity en masse. So this is what I see happening in the world, that happened in the world very recently. And this is what I think we should take as the North Star of the 21st century, because we're going to have these such incidents, such disasters, such, you know, incredible massive fear waves, let's say, and then we will have to deal with them. So what we did as humanity was befriending the fears. And the only way you can do it, to share it and to stand together. That's it.
What you're claiming is that we should have faith in us as humanity being able to be or to live in solidarity and to work from there.
Exactly. Well, I mean, like, when I mentioned this word faith, of course, many people think that I am talking something about, you know, new agey thing, or let's say a religious aspect of it. No, I'm talking about politics when I talk about let's have faith in ourselves, because what I see in the world right now is the lack of faith in humankind, of humankind. What neoliberalism did to us, of course, there's a long list of disasters that it caused, but at the very bottom of it, it ruined our faith in humans, because the fundamental definition of neoliberalism of the human is such a ridiculous, annoying, almost disgusting thing. Neoliberalism assumes us, the humans, to be self-centered, selfish bastards. And we somehow fell into the trap of believing this definition. And that's how our faith in ourselves, in our kind, have damaged severely. And that is why I think we cannot come together. That is why we cannot solve the problems of the world. Because many people think that, oh, okay, there isn't, we couldn't find that brilliant idea that will save all of us. We couldn't have the policies, proper policies that would change the world. No, the policies are there. The probable, you know, the possible policies are there. There are, you know, incredible number of great ideas to change the world, but then the political will is not there. So why are we lacking the political will? Because we do not have the faith. Because I do think that will comes from faith. Many people would say this, would, you know, define this lack as the lack of hope. I mean, they would think that it is the hope that is lacking. No, hope is everywhere. And hope, I think, has become a commodity. Anyway, that's one of the reasons I don't like the word. I mean, like, is this the system is constantly asking us, like, is there hope? And if we say hope, it somehow gives us the comfort of continuing our lives as they are. But faith, and which is the source of hope, if you ask me, is something else. And I'm, of course, talking about a secular faith here. And this is what's lacking. And it is all because neoliberalism defined the humankind in such a way that we cannot have faith. So this is something very political. Yes, of course, it is philosophical, but it has political consequences. I mean, like, if you think of a very, very small scale, let's say your neighborhood, Why don't you act for your neighborhood? Because you don't believe that others would do the same thing. And I'm asking the question, would your lack of faith be the same in 1960s? No. In the last decades, this lack of faith has been induced by this system, and that is something we have to take care of. We have to look into, at least.
Yeah, you just said that in the 1960s, you probably still would have faith. On the other hand, I'm thinking about, you know, big movements that could have been restorative for faith in humankind. You mentioned Black Lives Matter. I also think about, you know, Me Too, Turkey 2013, now Iran. But then a few years later, you have, you know, the situation that things got worse or that they went back in time. So how really to be able to keep up the faith, you know, when there are setbacks, when it seems like we're going backwards, abortion rights, going back in time. Like, what would you say to our listeners? How can we really restore that faith every day again and again?
Yeah, that is one of the reasons I prefer faith in humankind rather than hope, because once you look at the world, there are so many things to be hopeless about. And there are many, many setbacks. That's true. But faith is a decision. You make a decision that to be faithful, and then on, nothing can refute that. That is the magical ability of humankind, and that should be put into politics, in today's politics, I think, because we have the ability to invent fate, to keep on being faithful, and we have the ability to reinvent faith again when there are doubts. This is one part of it. But speaking of setbacks, from where I look, there are two things. Yes, there are setbacks because the masses are still learning. But the second part is they are learning. Kind of new politics, Occupy kind of politics, let's say, Occupy kind of political movements. They are learning each time, but what they couldn't learn, gives us those setbacks. They're spontaneous. They're like water, fluid. They're spontaneous. They come into the space, the political space, and what they couldn't learn so far is to retreat. So they cannot control their power yet. Imagine Gezi Uprising, Tahrir, or any other that kind of political movement. If they could have suddenly retreated before being suppressed, then these masses or this political action could have kept its power. Then it would have been a threat hanging on the, you know, on the heads of the political power. Like, when are they going to come back? Will they come back? And or how will they come back? And so on. The thing is, they cannot control their power yet. But I think by time, they will learn that too. Because, you know, I was in Tahrir, I was in Gezi, and I saw the, you know, previous such political actions as well. Each time they're learning something new. And yes, there are setbacks, that's for sure. But then they leave a mark and they change the discourse. They change the political narrative on a global level, which is incredibly important. For instance, right now, the climate crisis, young generation climate crisis actions, they are still learning. First, they started by asking from the adults to give them something. It was like that, like, you know, change the regulations, do this, do that. They were asking from European Union. They were asking from UN. And now, as they get older, they understand that it's not about them. It's about capitalism. And as they understand this, their discourse is changing to, you know, to challenge the capital. And then, like, in 2 years, we can see something else, you know, them becoming more politicized will might, you know, transform the political discourse or all around the world. So, yes, there are setbacks, but there is a learning process as well.
In your book, you also talk about the importance of attention or attentiveness. I read your book in German. That's why I don't know the translation, how you wrote it, actually. You know, there are so many things happening at the same time all over the world. We open up our feeds and we become witnesses to so many things happening right now that might make us feel powerless, absolutely powerless, because I'm seeing those protests in Iran and I think, okay, what can I do? Do you have any tips how we can put our attention together to gain strength from, you know, from being attentive? We can't be all over the place, right? I can't be there working for this issue and there working for that issue. What is your turn on that?
I wrote about attention as a replacement for excessive expression of anger. I wanted to, you know, point out the fact that with, you know, expression of anger, a lot of expression of anger on social media, we feel like we do something, you know, we've done something. We feel like this is action. It's not action, obviously. And that expression of anger is actually a tool for the social media companies to increase the interaction. So our anger is a commodity. So I was looking for something that cannot be commodified. So attention, genuine attention, I think cannot be commodified, one. And second, it is the only thing that can make us really connect to each other. Because if you pay attention, you always find the other people who really pay attention, people who go beyond expressing anger and do things. And unfortunately, doing things is far more boring than expressing anger on social media. It is like, it's a boring labor, of course. But then if you are truly paying attention to something, yes, you put that labor in what you want to change. It is not easy. It is almost impossible. I mean, like having written about attention, of course, in the morning, I go on Twitter and read completely irrelevant things. And then I find myself in this loop and so on. And there are many things happening in the world, and it is beyond our ability to attend to all of them. So I think in that case, one might want to choose a more local subject, because that is not as comfortable as choosing a global subject. Choosing a global subject to react or to change is somehow gives us the luxurious position of being abstract. You can say abstract things, like, you know, you can be, you can say that, oh, I am against war. Oh, good for you. But that's a big sentence, and it's abstract enough to allow you not to do anything. So maybe thinking locally and thinking globally but acting locally would be the answer to attention question. Because once you act locally, you can see that it takes a lot of time. You won't have time to go on social media to express your anger about a country that you don't know where or whatever. So yeah, I think acting locally would be the answer to that question. But even starting to realize that the time that anger takes, expressing anger takes from our lives is a pretty important progress, I think, in terms of not being enslaved by the social media and the horrifying transformation that it causes in our lives.
You mentioned before that if you, you know, do something locally, you go out and find maybe people, you know, working on the same cause. That brings me to another subject of your book, which is friendship. What role does friendship play in, let's say, transforming the world? Very big. And also, second part of my question would be, what role does it play in your life?
Oh, my life? That's, you know, I think it's the most central concept in my life, friendship. First of all, you know, if you're leading a life, a risky life, so to speak, like I do, yeah, friends are the only triangulation points, only bearings in your life. And, you know, I'm constantly moving now in Hamburg and around. So my understanding of home, for instance, is very much related to my friends. I kind of, in my head, replace the names of the cities with my, especially woman friends, you know, Brussels, it's Annelies, Tunis, it's Duda, whatever, you know, there are many, many women around the world who represent that city, and their houses and their divans most of the time are my homes. But friendship is a political and philosophical term. You know, since Aristo, so many philosophers thought about friendship, and I see friendship as the human relation that ultimate justice can be possible. It allows at least imagining the ultimate justice. It is a chosen relationship, and it is the relation of equals and so on. I was thinking about our political connections, like citizenship, of course, political membership, political party membership, or if you are in a community working for a political goal, that connection and so on. I think people right now, especially young generation, cannot be content with the formality of these relationships. So what they need, I thought, the connection they need should be more like a friendship. And social media, you know, despite having horrible, horrifying, you know, effects on our lives, it gives us that opportunity. I don't mean opportunity of connecting. I mean the opportunity of imagining equal relationships. Because, you know, I grew up and I wasn't already an adult when there was no social media. And the ones who know were speaking to the ones who don't. There was always an audience and a stage. There was always a microphone and on the other side, the silence. Now, for instance, after social media, this kind of relation, this kind of communication feels utterly ridiculous to me. Like, you know, why do we still do that stage thing? Like, everywhere is a stage. Everybody has a microphone. Everybody is both the spectacle and the audience. So this kind of communication, which is very new right now in the world, will, I think, inspire and reshape our political relations as well. So maybe that is why young people do not want a leader anymore, because they are born into this sort of very problematic equal relationship atmosphere. So now they are trying to create a new type of political leadership or political collective leadership and so on. So our communication, our way of communicating has always shaped our politics and shaped our understanding of ourselves throughout the history. And now it's happening once again. So the politics will be shaped by the social media, the friendship kind of communication social media is offering us, will change our political connections as well.
I was wondering if this is what you were trying with your letters from now, not being the person just talking to the audience, but, you know, connect to be equals and to discuss. Could you tell us? I read it's over now, unfortunately, the project, but could you tell us about the project?
I took a break rather because I want to write a book, and you know, I wanted to retreat to my chambers. So, and Letters from Now was a project that included almost 4,000 people from all around the world. I was doing it in English and in Turkish. And yes, it was an experiment, so to speak. to find out how we can communicate on equal grounds using the facilities that is offered to us by Digital Universe. So it was also an experiment how to humanize the digital universe. So I was writing letters every week, and the concept of the letters was generally the concepts of together. And each month we discussed with thousands of people what is dignity in 21st century, what is friendship, and so on. But we also talked about other things. And, the content was quite organic. It was also shaped by the letters that I received, which I read. And also we had Zoom meetings with the members every month. So it turned into a real friendship, not only my friendship to the readers, but also among the readers and writers as well, because they were writing letters as well. Yeah, that was the thing. I mean, like, I didn't expect them to read my letter. I actually expected them to write to me, because this is how it should be, a true equal communication. And I gave them my attention, and they gave, thankfully, their attention to me. I think this is, as far as I know, this is the first time people do this, but a group of people did this, but I think this will be the new course of communication in the future.
You just mentioned dignity, again, a term from your book, actually in the German title, Würde. It seems to me that some of the terms you're talking about have belonged into another sphere before, let's say like more a maybe religious sphere, you know, like the churches had the saying when it's about love, solidarity, friendship, dignity. Would you agree on that?
Absolutely. And this is unfair. And I do think that, like, that was the main idea, fundamental idea, behind together. Before I started writing it, we have to reclaim those words from the religious realm. We have to bring them back to the secular realm, into the, you know, daily politics, even radical love, which is very important. I mean, like, and these are not abstract, you know, mumblings, so to speak. In Turkey, where there is immense polarization, where there is proper fascism, the opposition party won the big cities in municipal elections by practicing radical love in politics. They said that we are going to embrace you all. We are not going to look for revenge, political revenge. We are all people of one nation, blah, blah, blah. And it worked. This is how they got the big cities in Turkey, you know, despite several serious hurdles coming from Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Radical love, faith, dignity, solidarity. These are, yeah, monopolized, let's say, by religion. That's true. And religion is said to be representative of the human heart. No, human heart invented religion because it needed faith. It needed to believe. The heart needed to believe. That's why the religion is invented. So we have to go back to that heart that invented religion, invented faith, invented love, or talk about love. And we have to bring all these things back to politics. Politics had these things already, like in 1960s, 70s. Now we have to ask them back. And we have to think about what stripped politics of these concepts. And I say it's neoliberalism. It is the policies of neoliberalism and the infiltration of neoliberal ideas to the depth of human heart. That is what stripped of politics of these concepts that are now monopolized by religion. We have to take them back. Easy peasy.
Easy peasy. Well, you said in another interview that people love to be afraid, that they love to be in that state and that they didn't want, you know, anyone to show them a way back. So if people don't want that, why should we?
Oh, yeah. I remember why I said that. How to Lose a Country was published, and the book was mostly saying, we're all going to be the victims of fascism. This is a global phenomenon, and so on. Yeah, there were these wide open eyes, hypnotized by my words. And there was a strange pleasure in listening to those horrifying words of mine when I was talking like a Cassandra. And then when I said, okay, let's find an answer to all these questions. Let's see how we are going to, you know, rescue ourselves from this. Let's see what can be the exit plan and so on. And that's how I wrote Together. And when I said, like, you know, and Together says, okay, we can do this. And this is how we can do this. The first reaction of people were refuting it, like, you know, and they were leaning back. And they were judging my ideas without giving a chance to see if it would really work for them. So I thought, okay, this is another, you know, shared mentality or shared reaction to the solutions in our age. We just don't want to believe in them. I think we are exhausted of disappointment so much that our first reaction to those who say that we can do this is no, we can't, without even listening to them. That's why faith is important, because you have to believe that you can do it, that we can, humankind can do it, and so on. And then on, you can pay attention to the ideas of solution, and then you can feel in friendship with those people who want to change the world. And then you can think about dignity as a central concept that should be the first rule, whatever the new, you know, whatever the new world would look like. It doesn't matter. Dignity should be our first, you know, priority and so on. Faith is important in that sense, because it takes away the arrogance. This is very, you know, I feel like I'm becoming a pastor now, but talking in a church, but it really takes away the arrogance of being a victim. You are not a victim. You are not, like, you know, you are not supposed to be whining about your victimhood and how we cannot do things. You have to pull your sleeves and, you know, start believing in the other people and in yourself as well. Otherwise, we're all fucked.
This podcast was brought to you by Good Impact. For more good talks, interesting people, and constructive solutions, go to goodimpact.eu.